is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Michael Jacobs. He's the president of Harry Abrams, or HNA Books, New York. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good, David. Good.
Michael, you probably better give your title and the corporate name correctly, because I tend to think of you as Abrams, but I know that you really identify it differently these days.
Well, actually, we don't. Well, so I'm the president and CEO of Harry N. Abrams Incorporated, as it's officially known, but we kind of refer to ourselves vernacularly as Abrams or Abrams Books, and sort of our corporate identity now is Abrams, the art of books since 1949, which is when the company was founded by the eponymous Harry N. Abrams.
And now owned, of course, by a French company.
Yeah, we're owned by a company called Le Martinier, based in Paris, who bought Abrams in 1996, before my time.
And how long have you been at Abrams now?
It'll be 7 years in June. I joined you and I both still call it the ABA, at the BEA in Chicago in 2004.
Right. And, of course, you joined Abrams, at a time when the business has been under some considerable challenge, and particularly, I think, what Abrams is most well-known for and really famous for is beautiful art books, heavily illustrated, expensive, the highest possible production values. And, of course, over the last, just at the time you were getting there, certainly was part of the beginning of a period when that kind of publishing has been under some pressure, I think.
Yeah, I think that, I'd agree with everything you said, except I don't think it was the beginning. I think it was either the middle or maybe even, it might have even peaked. I think that illustrated book publishing, probably over the last 10 to 15 years has been really under some stress. And, by and large, most of the major trade publishing companies had, all but abandoned visual book publishing, and in some ways, it had been left to a company like Abrams or some of our other competitors who were still trying to do what they had traditionally done for 30, 40, 50 years. So I think that, when I got here, it's not that we didn't have many competitors, but I think the competitive set was actually fairly limited. And most of the other big players had all but abandoned the visual book as something that they did one here and one there, but they didn't have a program that was comprised of illustrated publishing, with the exception of on the kids side, on the children's side, where many of them did still do.
Well, that's true.
Picture books and illustrated novels.
Right. Setting aside children's, which I know is still important to your business, but there, in fact, you are right. The competitive set is still fairly large. But given the challenges faced by illustrated book publishers, which are probably well known and don't need to be discussed in detail, but you've really expanded the business in many different ways, and I'm kind of curious to have you talk about what your strategy has been and how your strategy today may be different than it was 5 years ago, and how you're looking toward the future in terms of the illustrated book business.
Yeah, well, I think that not to be too blithe, but when I got into Abrams, it was pretty clear to me that there really wasn't an articulated strategy. There may have been a strategy, but it certainly wasn't one that had been articulated internally in the company, and its employees were just continuing to do what they'd always done, which was to make beautiful books and to feel really as good as they could about making beautiful books without real knowledge in some ways about whether the books were working commercially in the marketplace. And if anything, the company had gotten into the cycle that many publishing companies tend to fall into, which is to try to drive the top-line revenue by perhaps doing more books without much knowledge of what that actually was doing to the bottom line, and driving more revenue. In Abrams' case, was doing more books than it both was originating, was buying in from other publishers, and or taking from our parent company in France, who, in part, had bought Abrams as a way to bring more of the books that they were doing in their territory into North America, because, you know, most European and foreign publishers still look at America, and probably rightly so, as the biggest market that some of their books could reach. So the strategy, the unarticulated strategy anyway, was to do more books and to drive the top line. And it was I don't want to call it a disaster, but it was not a money making strategy, and it wasn't not a sustainable strategy. And it was a strategy, in fact, that was generating, you know, pretty high returns, because lots of those books didn't have a real market. Some of those books weren't even going to see the light of day and getting out of the warehouse. And some of the books that were brought in came late in the cycle, because illustrated publishing, not unlike the rest of publishing, but even more so, is kind of a back-ended business in the fourth quarter for gift-giving season. And so some of those books weren't getting into the marketplace until much too late and never had a chance to sell or establish themselves. So we were a company where, under the Abrams flagship imprint, and the company is comprised of several other imprints that I could talk about a little more as we go on, but under the Abrams flagship imprint, we were publishing, 125 new books a year. And today, 7 years later, we publish between 75 and 80 books under the Abrams imprint, and we've done a reasonable job of getting back to the same amount of revenue with publishing, considerably fewer books, 40 to 50% fewer books on our list. And consequently, the strategy in a nutshell has been to, make better selections and curate our list more effectively and sell more copies of the books that we publish, market them more aggressively, and drive the revenue per title rather than just the top line revenue.
Yeah, which certainly seems to have worked, and seems like a viable strategy for other publishers who are maybe not even illustrated book publishers could learn from what you've done. I think that it makes sense that, there's often the complaint about publishers that they publish books without thinking about the second half of the publishing equation, which, not thinking about it, but not executing well enough on it, I should say, which is, the marketing and sales of the book.
I don't know, probably some of my colleagues would say this was not to my credit, but fortunately or unfortunately, I came up on that side of the business. I was a sales guy to begin with, and I became a marketer as my career, evolved. And so I guess I grew up on the end of the business that, was, okay, we're publishing it. What are you going to do with it? And not on the editorial side, where I was a creator of or an emanator of content. So I didn't have the same illusion about the need to sell.
Right. Well, yeah. I think that dynamic is actually pretty valuable too. The editorial to sales dynamic. Who's got who has what to say about what, kind of makes a big difference in how a publisher will succeed.
I think, going back to what we've done, what we continue to do, because I guess I'm a fairly superstitious person, so I'm never comfortable saying what we've accomplished, but more what we're in the process of doing, because if it's good, I don't want it to end by my jinxing it in any way. But it has been a process, and it continues to be a process of change. It's about not being comfortable or satisfied doing the things the same way they've always been done. And so we really went back to basics. I mean, it was a little bit like, boot camp here for a long time. And we had lots of turnover. We had lots of churn. Luckily, not with some more senior people who have, remained here and become the core of my management team, although some of them changed as well. But a lot of people who just weren't up for the pace of change that I thought was necessary and for us to get where we needed to be, and that, and that started with completely reevaluating our acquisition P&L, the pro forma that we look at when we're actually considering a project. It's editorial merit aside, whether or not we, could afford to do it, and how many we'd have to sell, and what the metrics were that we needed to measure in order to make it seem like, at least on paper, which of course is always, an idealized version, whether it was worth our time to pursue the project. So we really, we kind of went under the hood, as I like to say. We sort of, learned to become mechanics, after we owned the car. And I think it was and remains an invaluable skill that we continue to hone. We continue to revise that P&L. People who come to our publication board meeting, who are editors, are required to understand what they put down on that piece of paper, because they're queried about it, and we tweak it, and we spend a lot of time looking at, at those metrics, at those levers of what this project could provide for us in terms of revenue or income, more importantly, and evaluate it on that basis, as well as its editorial, the passion that the editor brings to it. The conversations now that we have at Pub Board are, I don't want to say they're rarely about the editorial content, but we, I tend to let people buy things they feel passionate about, as long as on the piece of paper that the group that needs to commit to those goals feel are attainable.
Great. So it seems like the formula is, if you can make it a formula, get really good people to acquire books, and then apply the kind of sales and marketing metrics and product, and the production side metrics, so that you kind of start from the basis that the books are good. The real question is, how can they sell? It's almost like a one of the high end colleges will say, we have, out of the 20,000 people that apply to our school for 1,500 places, we get 10,000 or 12,000 applicants who we know are absolutely qualified. But what we choose, then we have to make this really complex decision about who actually gets in based on other criteria. And in a way, that's what you're saying. There are many really publishable books. The issue is not going to be whether it's a good book or a publishable book, but whether it will meet the needs of the business to be successful.
Yeah, I would agree with probably about 90% of that, and the 10% I wouldn't agree with or don't agree with, or I could say, is the books could always be better, which, of course, my editors think is just me being flippant, and maybe it is, but I think that, we have a little, we have lots of little sayings around, at least I do, so people make fun of them, but, I like bigger thoughts, I like things. It doesn't mean everything has, if they're all bigger thoughts, then none of them are bigger, but I think that relatively there need to be some bigger thoughts, because the bigger thoughts often pay for the smaller, more passionate thoughts, So
yeah.
The bigger passionate thoughts are the best thoughts of all in terms of publishing.
Right.
Because
But you can't guarantee that those are going to be the ones you get.
No, you can't, but I think, sometimes, the process of achieving, begins with envisioning or thinking it or articulating it, and I think that we are getting better at that. I don't say to the editors, just buy big books. I let them and bring books that they're intrinsic and extrinsic reasons why you buy a book, and I appreciate all those reasons, but I think that in order for the enterprise to to remain sustainably profitable, that some bigger thoughts, and it only makes sense, because if you're going to do fewer things, then some of those things have to be bigger. As I say around here a lot, look, if we can hit 250, we probably can stay in the big leagues if our glove's good. But if we hit 300, we're all stars, and and if you hit 350, you may go in the Hall of Fame. So it's about improving the batting average, and you got to see the pitches that you can hit, and you got to hit them.
Right, but you need a mixture of singles, doubles, triples, and homers.
Yeah.
Just like a baseball player.
Sometimes grand slams don't hurt either.
That's true. Well, we could go on with that, with the analogy to baseball. It actually does work pretty well, I think. But I had another question I think I wanted to ask about, given that you know, you have this kind of handle on what you call the under the hood. You know, I presume you still have to worry about the outside factors. You know, recently, with, for instance, as we've, you know, we know with borders, situation being what it is, you're losing a big chunk of what was your retail marketplace. You know, maybe some of that will come back. Others will open, you know, stores, and or maybe some of those stores will stay around. But clearly, the physical bricks and mortar business continues to be under stress. And I guess, you know, thinking ahead, you know, as every publisher must look ahead, what are your thoughts about that? How is your business going to work in a declining shelf space model?
Well, again, this is, you know, this has not, didn't happen overnight. And, you know, while Borders, you know, current situation and what feels to be their, you know, their continuing demise, you know, has seemed imminent for a long time. And if one was paying attention, probably we could have tracked it 2 and 3 and 4 years ago. So I think it's part of a trend. I think the answer for us is not an answer. It really is our strategy for some time here, and one that I've again tried to articulate around the company is we, you know, we consistently need to publish books that aren't going to just sell in bookstores. We need to sell, you know, publish books, some of which will sell in places that, you know, that aren't bookstores, but that may sell books in specialty markets and gift shops and museum stores and, you know, in online retailers, both book and otherwise, and in export markets in the English language, which is, you know, a huge opportunity for us. We publish, we have an office in the UK that sells our books in the UK and in the English language in across Europe and Asia and Africa and New Zealand and Australia. Those are tremendous growth opportunities for us. So we, you know, we're always looking to sell our books in places that are, you know, in addition to traditional bookstores, which, to your point, has been a, you know, a continually, you know, consolidating, you know, channel. And on the other end of the spectrum, you know, we have some books that we can sell in the mass market, and, you know, in Target and Walmart and mass merchandisers. Not a lot of our list, but some of it, and that's been a benefit to us as well, in part because we've struck gold with a children's series that has helped propel our business in all kinds of ways, and frankly, given us more time to continue to make change.
Well, you're talking about Diary of a Wimpy Kid,
uh-huh,
and the whole series that has come after that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's been a tremendous, as we say, home run, grand slam.
Grand slam.
But so, what are your thoughts these days? I know you and I, in other occasions, have talked about the whole concept of publishers selling direct to consumer, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about your particular end of the business, or if you want to generalize about what you think publishers, other publishers, might be thinking about this. You know, how does that fit in?
Yeah, I can't really. I mean, I can speculate about other publishers. I can talk much more, you know, directly about our own thoughts or my own thoughts about it. I don't think it's something we do very well, and I don't think it's something that right now in our kind of evolution and life cycle that we are going to spend much more time focusing on. We're not a retailer. We don't do that. We don't really know how to sell directly to people. We sell books on our website, but we sell books on our website for people who can't find them elsewhere. And we use our website primarily to market and publicize and to talk about what we do as a publisher and our authors and illustrators and our company culture. So it's not an area that I think we're well suited to go after, you know. And, you know, that's, like everything else, kind of a double-edged sword, because on the other hand, as publishers, and you know this as well as I do historically, we've never been particularly adept at talking directly or communicating directly to the end user, the consumer. We don't have the kind of money or spend the kind of money to, you know, to target those people. But I also say that, you know, what our core competency is in curating, you know, book publishing and making beautiful books and distributing them well and having relationships with all kinds of retailers and looking for new channels of distribution. And our core competency isn't, nor will it be in the near term, in my view, actually selling directly to consumers.
No, that makes sense and understandable. So, but also I assume all that it remains true that the online resellers are take a big chunk of your business because for some of the reasons that are structural to the industry where big illustrated expensive books get less shelf space in physical stores than they used to, and they are also expensive and can be, where there are retailers discounting, those retailers can really make a difference to the consumer in terms of price. So I presume that remains true that a lot of your business is going to be online through resellers.
Yeah, there's no doubt that that the online retailers have been growing as a percentage of our overall business, and I believe will continue to grow. And I don't think in some ways that we're much different than people who don't do illustrated books in that regard. But to your point, which I think is a very valid one, lots of what we do, not everything, but lots of what we do on the more high-end, more expensive side, isn't what I'd call portable. You don't see that many people carrying our books around on the subway or bus while they're commuting. And if you're going to spend $50 or $60 or $85 on a beautiful illustrated book, you probably want one that's in fairly pristine condition and arrives to your home in a well, packaged box and has, practically never been touched by human hands. So I think there are all kinds of underlying reasons why our business has, been particularly well suited for growth in online retail. I think the other thing we see, and I wouldn't doubt again that that other publishers differ much in this regard, is that when we get publicity or our marketing hits for our books, where we really can track most clearly the blip in sales are online. People see publicity about our books in magazines or on blogs or on websites or in reviews or wherever they see it, and where we see the needle move most often is in the online retailers.
Right. No, I think that's very common now for almost all publishers. It's, the old model was kind of put the books in stores, get publicity, and hope that people would then go to stores and find your book. What, of course, now happens is you get publicity, people instantly, or at least large numbers of people, click online to their favorite reseller, and brilliantly, I think for publishers, you can the book is always there, and you don't have to leave your home. You don't have to remember the name of the book or what was that thing you just heard on the radio. You can just click over and there it is. And with mobile browsers, you could be at work, you could be on a line somewhere, you could be on this, just about to get on the subway, you hear something interesting, you can go buy the book.
Yeah, still makes my heart beat fast to see our books displayed in public places,
Well, let me ask you, because it's inevitable the question has to arise then about, as you kind of led me to this by reminding me that art books are heavy and people don't typically carry them around. And of course, people more and more people have iPads, maybe they'll have other tablets. The iPad in particular seems extremely well suited to consuming illustrated books. The color is fantastic, the display and the ability to move from page to page, the ability to have maybe enhanced features, all of those things seem to make it an obvious platform for illustrated books. And I'm curious to know whether, that's something you're looking at or exploring in a big way, or are you still, kind of, or I guess, where are you with that?
Well, the answer is yes to all that. We're exploring it in a big way. We finally, after a pretty deliberative process and some long-term, consultancy with a sort of a digital advisor, we've hired somebody as of this past September to be our head of our what we call our digital assets, direct our digital assets. And and we're teeing lots of things up for all the devices that are out there now. And to your point, we think now that there is an iPad and there are certainly going to be other tablets that follow, we think that there is finally now a delivery mechanism for four color illustrated book content. What the pricing model is on that, what people are willing to pay, whether it needs to be enhanced, whether the page flow and design will continue, which we believe it will continue to evolve and get better. We feel that there's a tremendous opportunity for us to grow our business in the digital realm, and we've been in it sort of with a couple of our toes for a while, most specifically on our two color content, our text driven content, which mostly is in our middle grade and young adult fiction for kids, and that we're accelerating as well. And we paid attention as well as the press and the media have to the fact that it seemed at Christmas time that lots of kids got Kindles or Nooks, or maybe the rich kids got iPads, and a lot more children's content seems to be being sold digitally, so that's an opportunity for us as well. But yeah, on the four color front, I think that it's the beginning of a new frontier. But what that pricing model is, what people will pay for a digital edition of a book that we might sell for $40 or $50 is to be determined. And we see that as this is a time for us to experiment and try things out. But we from a corporate and strategy perspective, what we really had needed to do, and what our digital assets director's primary mission is to get our internal process lined up in a way that when we're making a physical book, we're also providing ourselves with the ability to make the assets that can make a digital book at the same time.
Right. So that
reinventing the wheel. Yeah.
So that the files. I mean, I actually had a similar conversation with Phil Alilla at Ingram about workflow. That the kind of holy grail for publishers, I think, is going to be able to have files that can be easily deployed into whatever format a book may need to be in, or all formats, so that it's not as it has been for the last few years. You publish the book and then convert it to an e-form, whereas I think at least we can envision a time when the book is designed from the ground up to be in a digital form that allows it to be either printed or made into an e-book or made into something else. We don't even know what that might be.
Yeah, no, the process work is something I hesitate to say embraced, because I've embraced it, and I'm looking for a few other good men and women to embrace it as deeply as I have. But I think if I had to sort of, really be, clear-eyed about my tenure at Abrams, it's been pretty doggedly after let's look at our process in all kinds of ways and see if we can see how we can improve it. We need to improve it, because it's what my job here is to get people to be freed up to be more creative and to do what they do well, and stop being attached to inefficient processes. So this is just one of those things that we're a company that, because of how this company evolved, didn't spend a hell of a lot of time or money or resource in process, systems, workflow, all that kind of, again, unsexy, under the hood stuff. So that remains a mission of mine, and I'm pretty dogged and relentless about it. So that's work that that lots of people don't really want to focus on, but we're doing it in our way, and it's paying dividends. The more time we can free people up to be creative about acquiring and designing and making and selling and marketing books without having to go through 197 steps, which we've charted it, that how many steps it has traditionally taken us to actually make a book, and however many months that entails, we take some of those steps out of the process, we compress some of that time, we can be more quicker to market, we can focus on more opportunity, we can be more productive, we can weather downturns with more flexibility. All that, in my view, flows from the rather unsexy work of process.
Well, I know you got to go soon, but I wanted to ask you about that process question, because as most people know, I think when you print, most illustrated books nowadays are printed in Asia. Mm-hmm. The production and delivery time is actually pretty lengthy, and I remember a couple of years ago, I think this was early in your tenure, when the delivery of books of all commerce coming from Asia into the United States was held up because of the security concerns, and you'd have boats backed up because there was no one who can inspect all the stuff coming in fast enough. So you missed, I think you and a lot of other publishers had books that didn't make it in time for Christmas, let's say. So my question there is not so, I guess it is kind of to the point of, since printing is so important to you as a company, are you looking at all the time at developments in printing, where somebody might be able to shave cost out to make it possible for you to print in U.S. and Canadian plants, which give you a quicker turnaround time? We're looking at some of the developments in digital printing that enable color printing to be done in a completely different way. Is that something that's important for you to be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, to the first part of the question, without a doubt. I mean, one of the things that we have done successfully, and again, it's ongoing work, is compress the schedule so that we when I got here within the first 2 years, I'd sort of set down a goal for our production director, then production director, to let's take a month out of the schedule and figure out how to do that, and we were successful in doing that. But the other aspect that you touched upon is we're looking for, and we have taken advantage of many more domestic printing opportunities, and as things continue to evolve and change in China, and currency exchange and labor issues and overall material has become more expensive, and certainly fuel is a bigger part of the equation as well. Transport, we have printed much more domestically, and what we often do, which is part of our regular drill now, is when we may do a first printing in Asia and have film available to reprint in America. If the book works. I mean, when I first got to Abrams, one of the big eye-opening lessons for me was, you can never get the number right. You either printed too many and you were stuck with them, or you didn't print enough and you couldn't get back in stock in time if the book worked. So it seemed like a bit of a conundrum. So now we oftentimes are betting on the come that we can reprint in the United States, and it may cost us a little more, but the time back to market will more than offset that additional expense. So we're looking at all that options at CNN. We continue to do it. We have a really fabulous production group and a great production director, and that's part of our toolkit.
Well, it's I think there's so many other things we could talk about, but I know you have to go, and I think it's been really interesting to hear you talk about the business. I think there's so many challenges for publishers. It's I really admire your success.
Well, thanks, David. It's nice to talk to you as well. And I guess the last thing I'd say, and this is not just about me, but when I came to Abrams almost 7 years ago now, I had just left about a 7-year stint at Scholastic, where I sort of overseen the publication, distribution, marketing, and sales of the first 5 Harry Potter books. So that was kind of an amazing publishing experience, and I wasn't intending to go back to work right away after I left there. And I was approached about this job, to my surprise, and really approached it almost as a consultancy, rather dispassionately, which didn't last very long once I got here, since I'm not made that way. On the other hand, I try to keep in mind the fact that it's about trying to stay open to learning new things, and to question one's assumptions, and to try to instill that in people here as well. And it never hurts to get lucky. So we, along the way, while we've been doing this pretty intensive process work, we've had the great fortune of getting lucky with a huge children's property as well, which is, as I said, both bought us some time and got us through that very severe downturn a couple of years ago without having to cut staff or severely cut back on our plans to do what we intended to do. I like to say that we're on a creative diet, so we like to stay lean and hungry. We like to stay the size we are. We're not intending to take over the world. We just want to be pound for pound about as good as we can be in our weight class.
Well, typically, you know, one says that you create the conditions for good luck to occur. So I think that's probably what you've done, and then you get to reap the benefit from having that luck in the first place.
Yeah. Anyway, but it's fun, and it's we're living in interesting times, as they say.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much, Michael, for talking to me. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Michael Jacobs, the CEO and president of Abrams Books. Thanks so much.